Hi, everyone. First of all, this title, I'm not responsible for this title, A Family's Journey Towards Doing Justice. Our family is chaotic. We have six of us, four children, ages 11 through three boys, 11, 15, 17, and my daughter's 20, and justice. I don't know if you want to hear the kind of justice that sometimes happens in our family, but it's never dull, and it's quite a journey. But I think, did you want to start off? Huh?
Sure.
Okay.
I mean, I feel like I'm amongst family here, for sure. So, hello. One of the things that, starting from the back end, from the most current, is I think we are, along with all of you, just part of this fresh wind of the Spirit that's blowing all over the world. And I'm amazed at how much it resonates, what one person shares. It just has so resonated with me, from worship conferences that I've been to lately to, the Simple Churches, to Dave's series in October. Wherever we go, it seems the same message. But we have most recently felt the need to take our kids out of the bubble and to take them for a month. We took them this summer for a month to Thailand. And just for them, they've never really been anywhere like that, certainly to a developing country, or whatever you want to call the country of Thailand, but just to see slums and to see how wealthy we are here. It was just very powerful for all of them, and visiting, having the privilege to visit orphanages where Chinita came from and to experience Bangkok for a length of time, it was phenomenal. But the journey of that, it has been a journey of compassion that started with when we went on a mission first, which was to plant a church. So we were privileged to be sent on a team that planted a church in Deep Cove, and many of you are here from the Cove, and we thought we were going to do mission and to do bring justice and to reach into our community in a deeper way to people that didn't know Christ and to begin there. But what happened was we just got totally blindsided. You think you're going to do something, and then you never are quite prepared for what actually happens. And as a result of going to plant this church, it was as if we got a second chance, really, a second chance at being followers of Jesus, and which we're very thankful for the opportunity to be sent. But it wasn't what we thought. And instead of going to win people and to, be this missional community, we got turned inside out. And it was a chance, the first wind of the Spirit that I heard, because we were kind of chomping at the bit, okay, how do we get into these neighborhoods and, reach more people for God? And God just said, the Spirit just very kindly said, slow down. And it was just like, what? Slow down. We're trying to get busy here. We gotta do more. We've got to do more. And it was from that process of saying, well, what does that look like? And then being willing to stop doing so much and to wait, which is not something that comes naturally to me at all. And then out of the waiting, this whole sense of the compassion of God, first for me, and really, that has been the journey. It's a journey of compassion, first hearing the voice of the Spirit for myself as a person, not as a doer, but just the heart of God for myself, and then to be able to see Jesus in me and Jesus in every face that we meet. And so we have been on this journey together, and it is as if our eyes have been opened to really this whole concept of who is our neighbor, as Andy was talking about, and really what is the Spirit saying. And I think it isn't like one formula. It is as unique as each of us is this journey of how does God see us, and then from that place allowing that same compassion that we've received and the grace we've received to then extend outwards. And I guess as a bottom line, the Spirit has said, live on less, give away more, get a global vision. And we're thinking, yeah, how do we, what does, you know, engaging this question with the Spirit, what does that look like for us? We have four kids. We live on the North Shore. You know, we've got our kids involved in sports and whatever else, music. And, you know, if any of you have kids, you know, it's hectic. And how do you stay calm and find justice in that and teach that, you know, through our lives? So we are very much on this journey, and it has started with us. And so out of slowing down and allowing this and taking time to listen to the Spirit, to hear things of the Spirit to us directly, it's totally impacted our marriage, our relationship. And as I've slowed down, it stirs up a discontent, if you will, a personal, there's a reason why I go at Mach 3 most of my life. And so there's a bit of an angst that comes with listening to the Spirit, but just to keep with Him and moving forward in our on our journey together and individually, and then as parents. Sometimes, don't you feel you just want the world to stop so you can figure the whole thing out? And then, you know, but the Spirit doesn't work that way because, you know, He's just so kind and so compassionate for right where we are, so relevant. One of my passions is for the Church of Jesus Christ to be relevant to my kids' friends, my kids, you know, their generation. And what does that look like? And it has really started with simply listening to the Spirit as one individual person and obeying what the Spirit says to do. So that's where I'd leave off.
So listening to the Spirit and then obeying. Well, listening to the Spirit can be challenging at times, but the next part, obeying it, is even more so. And in my case, in my experience, I received the prompting from the Spirit a couple years ago to confess something that I had been sitting on for many years. And so through that confession and bringing it out into light, it really created chaos, and down I went. But in that process, I was like unwound, remade, and for the first time could see the depravity in my heart. But and then feeling that and feeling like I'm drowning and still trying to live and operate. But then the light bursts in, even in that depravity, even in the darkness of my soul, God loves me. And when that is experienced, it's like a new birth and a new identity, and seeing God or seeing myself as God sees me, not as I see myself. So that was a process. And that kind of, we've been on that for a few years now. And so now it's like we're seeing the world differently. Things we never noticed before or took for granted, we see differently now. And it's the Spirit, I think, that awakens us and gives us that opportunity. And Wendy mentioned, we just sense, here we are, we're living in the bubble, Norfan. We really sense this is our home, our tribe. And at the same time, it's like, make a good wage, good salary, have a home, very affluent on a world scale, right? Like 95% of people probably live with a lot less than we do here. Yet at the same time, there's that affluence, but it doesn't feel that way. There's an impoverished affluence. Pete McMartin in the Vancouver Sun wrote an article, and it's an impoverished affluence. So even though we got so much, it doesn't feel like it. So I'm living beyond my means and spending more than what I bring in. And we're kind of getting away with it by happen to have some equity, and these house prices are rising way too high, and so we just go to the line of credit, right? So we're living like this, and so I'm starting to share this with more people, and I'm finding out I'm not alone. There's a lot of people that may be living beyond their means, right? So it's kind of put us on this, and we don't have all the answers. Like, I mean, we're still stumbling along. Like, I think this should really be two fools on the road to kingdom living, hopefully. And that would be good. But So I don't know if that makes sense or not, but so we really feel, we sat down with our kids. Now this was a fun family meeting when we sat down and said, okay, kids, I know you're used to, you know, your thumbs are pretty well exercised and you're really good in front of the PlayStation and stuff, and we got a nice thing going here, but we just sense that, hey, we need to hold things loosely. We need to spend less. We need to give away more, because with this impoverished affluence comes a scarcity mindset, and we need to be more generous and not scarce with what we have. So spend less, hold things loosely, spend less, give away more, get a global vision. So part of the Thailand thing was going to Thailand. We did the backpacking thing, guest house, different experience, great experience for the whole family. But I mean, not everyone's on board. I mean, this is it's not an easy thing to break away from. And that's why we need the Spirit of God, and that's why we need each other to encourage each other. And you know, we don't have all the answers, but someone's got an experience, and the Spirit's talking to them and shares it with someone else. And wait, there's a different way of living here. So we really feel that there's something happening. We're not there yet, and it's a journey, but it's an exciting journey that hopefully we can all be in together.
Trying to think of something witty to say about you two being two fools, but nothing appropriate comes to mind. So, carrying along. So, we're going to ask Dave to come and share now. I wanted to give you a word of instruction. This is the introvert question and answer card. So, for those of you that are maybe more introverted and you're sitting here listening thinking, boy, I've got a great question, but there's no way I'd raise my hand later on during the question and answer time. This is for you, okay? So if you have a question, they're at the end of your pews. There should be a stack of them at the end of all the little pews there. And maybe if you have a question that you think, I'd like that responded to, you can jot it down, and we'll throw it in the box up here, and then later on in our question and answer session, we'll go to it from there. So Dave, come on up and share with us. I honestly don't know Dave well enough to introduce him, so I won't introduce him. But I do know people that have been impacted by Dave, and their lives have been transformed by the grace of Jesus in him. So we just believe that Jesus is going to use you here in our midst as well. So can I pray for you?
Yeah.
Jesus, I just thank you that Dave can be with us. I thank you for your story in him and what you're doing. And we welcome your word through him tonight. Amen. Bless you. Overhead. Yes, I will. Yes.
Did everyone get the handouts?
No.
It's good to be here. I mean, I always think it's kind of trippy when, you know, people busy, could be doing a lot of things. Come together for an evening to think about what's going on in their lives, what's going on in the world, how do we live, and how does you know, this journey of faith matter in our lives, and particularly this issue of justice, which is pretty interesting because it seems like, you know, it for a long time didn't get too much airplay. And there's something happening. People are beginning to say this is important, and let's talk about it. And in talking with Andy, he had said during the time of prayer, Amos kept coming up. And so I want to talk about Amos. It's a book that is of particular interest for me, and so I want to spend tonight doing that. And it's also kind of intriguing that he made reference to the Good Samaritan story, because on Wednesday night I want to talk about that. And we're going to look at Luke 10. But maybe from an angle or drawing things out of the story that aren't normally given much attention. So I think it would be interesting. So let's. I want to set the framework for the book of Amos by looking at a couple of other passages. And in particular, when we're talking about justice, we're talking about power and how power is distributed. I mean political, social, economic power. How it's distributed, where it's concentrated, how the inequities take root, and so on. And one of the things about the biblical tradition that you find is this theme of justice. And interestingly enough, for example, in Psalm 72, it's actually the person who holds the most political power, namely the king, who is called upon to ensure justice for the weakest people in his realm. And so you have this amazing passage, a couple of passages from Psalm 72. Give the king your justice, O God, and your righteousness to a king's son. May he judge your people with righteousness and your poor with justice. May the mountains yield prosperity for the people and the hills in righteousness. May he defend the cause of the poor of the people, give deliverance to the needy, and crush the oppressor. And then a few lines later, talking about the king, for he delivers the needy when they call, the poor and those who have no helper. He has pity on the weak and the needy and saves the lives of the needy. From oppression and violence he redeems their life, and precious is their blood in his sight. Now that is amazing text, because in this passage, the king that holds ultimate power within the realm of Israel or Judah or any other nation is precisely the one who is to ensure the protection and care of the most vulnerable in that society. And even to the extent that the king here is responding to the needs of people, poor people, people who are weak, people who are vulnerable, and that last line, those who are under oppression or violence, perhaps from, you know, the other forces in society around them. And it says that their blood is precious in his sight. Now, I don't know if you caught the story in the Globe and Mail about Wheels. This guy, they're doing a series on homelessness in the Globe and Mail and CKNW. And so it was really a personal story of one guy who died on the street on a cold night. Who was in a wheelchair and so on, and a bit about his life. Now, I bet you that people in power don't find his blood very precious, or they wouldn't let him die on the street. We can tell what's important to people because of where they put their time, their effort, their attention, their energy, their resources. If something is precious, they give it that kind of attention. And so people, as homelessness increases around us, as poverty increases, when the province announces a $2.3 billion surplus, and yet we lead the nation in child poverty, we can say the poor people are not precious to those in power. They are not. And yet this is, notice the first line, give the king your justice, O God. All right? It's not just the king making this up as he goes. This is divine justice at work through this person of political power who takes a stand on the side of those who are most vulnerable and the weakest. That is biblical justice. That's divine justice. And we're going to see how that works itself out. Okay, the reality, though, is that it doesn't always work that way. Kings aren't quite that interested in people on the bottom, it turns out. And in fact, in Deuteronomy, there's a section in Deuteronomy where the concern is giving guidance and legislation, instruction for the leaders of the society, for priests, for judges, and for the king. And in this particular section of Deuteronomy where he talks about royal power, it's very Moses is very careful to frame royal power within the confines of Torah, okay, divine instruction. And so in saying, well, okay, if you're going to have a king, this is what you need to do. Make sure the king is an Israelite and not somebody from outside, because they're going to bring in other kinds of concerns. They're not going to be particularly concerned about Torah and keeping the divine covenant. Don't acquire a lot of horses. That's military power. You don't need to go out and build your military in some extravagant way. and, you know, amass power that way. Don't acquire many wives. Well, this isn't just, you know, wives as sexual partners or something like that. This has to do with alliances with other nations, drawing up political deals in which perhaps deals that are beneficial to you because you can have access to other people's resources and so on. There's going to be influences that come in and draw you away from this covenant commitment. But no, don't go in those directions, but instead make sure you have a copy of the Torah, copy of the law, with you at all times in your presence. And make sure you read it and make sure you submit to it. Now, you think, okay, well, whatever. Like, so you're reading those dry, boring laws. No, wait, hang on a second. Those laws, if you look at elements of the Book of the Covenant from Exodus 21 to 23, or the Deuteronomic laws, I mean, those laws are setting down instructions for how to live as the Exodus people in the land. In other words, as they're coming out of the land and God is going to give them this Torah, this instruction on how to set up a society and how to be together in community, he says, don't imitate Egypt. We don't want oppression here. We don't want exploitation. We don't want abuse of slaves and so on and so on. We don't want that kind of society. You're my people. And as Psalm 72 says, this is my kind of justice. And so we're going to set up a society in which people are treated with respect, dignity, resources are made available. So if you're plowing your fields, if you're harvesting your field, leave the edges for people who don't have any. If you have a day laborer, make sure make sure you pay them at the end of the day. All kinds of things are set in place. How about the law of the Shemitah? Every 7 years, a remission of debt, so people can find their way back into society and not this free fall into endless poverty. So these kind of laws are set in place to make sure there's a kind of economic equality, economic participation of people in society. People are not left out and excluded. This is in the Torah. And this is the Torah that the king is supposed to read every year, and it's going to inform him. And he's to diligently observe all that the law requires. And notice, neither exalting himself above other members of the community, nor turning aside from the commandment, either to the right or the left. And so there's a sense of equality, a sense of, I am my brother's keeper. Okay? So that's what the king is supposed to do, be guided by Torah, by this covenant, and by the God who endorses this covenant. Well, okay, things didn't really turn out that way very well. So the matter of fact is that when kings became kings, often they took power and turned it to their own advantage and made use of it for their own self-interest. And this starts right from the beginning. So the passage from Samuel. People come to Samuel and say, we want a king like all the other nations to lead us into war and, you know, and so on. And Yahweh's not really that happy with them. And he says to Samuel, okay, what I want you to do is I want you to show them the ways of a king. Tell them what a king will be like. And so Samuel says to them, if you flip the page, so Samuel reported all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking him for a king, and he said, well, these will be the ways of a king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them to his chariots and to be his horsemen and to run before his chariots, and he will appoint for himself commanders of thousands, commanders of fifties, and some to plow the ground and to reap the harvest and to make his implements of war and his equipment of his chariots. And he will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers, and he will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive orchards and give them to his courtiers, and he will take one-tenth of your grain and of your vineyards and give it to his officers and his courtiers, and he will take your male and female servants, slaves, and the best of your cattle and donkeys and put them to his work, and he will take one-tenth of your flock, and you shall be his slaves. Welcome to Egypt. You just returned there. So you've got this concentration of power that turns out to be power used for the interest of the king and his regime, and the king and his palace, and the officials that rule with him. And the rest of the people will be slaves. all those resources are going to be brought to into the concentrated place in the palace. And then it says, in that day you will cry out. Where was the last time they cried out? In Egypt, under servitude. And so what Samuel's saying is, you're going to return to that place of slavery, because this kind of political power is going to turn itself into something malevolent. Well, did it really happen? Well, remember David? So what does David do? He takes Bathsheba. And he has Uriah killed. And so Nathan shows up and says to him, let me tell you a story. There were two men in a certain city. One was rich and the other poor. And the rich man had very many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing but one little ewe lamb, which he had bought. He brought it up, and it grew up with him and with his children. And it used to eat his meager fare and drink of his cup and lie in his bosom, and it was like a daughter to him. Now there came a traveler to the rich man, and he was loath to take one of his own flock or herd to prepare for the wayfarer who had come to him. But he took the poor man's lamb and prepared that for the guest who had come to him. This is an amazing story because, you know, of course, David says, who is this guy? He's going to have to pay, you know, fourfold. He's going to return this. And then, of course, Nathan says, Ataha Ish, you are the man. You are the one. David got caught in this story. He got caught in the narrative and exposed for the way in which he was abusing power. And he did what Samuel said. Samuel said, a king will take, and he will take, and he will take, and he will take, and he will take. And that's what happened. And in this, the story, of course, it's the one who is powerful who takes advantage of the one who has less power and takes advantage for his own pleasure, well-being, and so on. This is what happens with power. And then when we come to Solomon, well, Solomon makes things even worse. He has a large harem, which Deuteronomy said don't do. He has an elaborate bureaucracy. He has a standing army. He has conscripted labor, heavy taxation, and a lot of wealth for the ruling elite. A description there of 1 Kings 4 of a lavish banquet and endless cattle that are killed for meat to supply as food for the ruling class. And of course, the heavy taxation was the reason for the kingdom splitting in the offspring of Solomon, Rehoboam, who the people said the taxes are too heavy, we can't bear it, and you know, you got to cut back on that for us. And they said no. He said no, and then there was a revolt, and the kingdom split. And so this development of power that turns in on itself for its own pleasure and for its own accumulation, and so on. And then finally, Ahab, just one story out of 1 Kings 21, where he, you remember the story where he looks out of his palace and he sees this vineyard of Naboth, and he says, I want that. And he comes to Naboth, he says, okay, listen, can I have your field? And Naboth says, no, it's a family inheritance. Like, I can't just go passing it on to you. And Ahab is a bit upset, so he comes back, and Jezebel says, what's wrong? Well, I really want that field, but he ain't going to give it to me. She says, what? Don't you know you're the king? What do you mean? Just take it. And so they, you know, put together this elaborate ruse of accusing the guy falsely of certain charges and then bringing before like a bunch of people who were willing to testify against him. And he was stoned to death, and they took the field. But then Elijah shows up. He meets Ahab in the field and he confronts him with what he's done. And see, this is the place of the prophetic voice. Right. This is why I'm. This is why I'm doing this. We're getting to Amos, but this is the place of the prophetic voice. The prophetic voice stands before power, and says, "This is excessive. This is brutal. This is exploitative. This is against the vision of a community life that Yahweh desires." And that's where we come to the book of Amos. Because in fact, Amos is a very powerful speaker from within this prophetic tradition of calling into account this reign of power that is used for its own self-interest. And Walter Brueggemann, if you get a chance to read Brueggemann's Prophetic Imagination, it's an amazing book. And one of the things he outlines, although he does it by looking at the rule of Solomon, but I'm going to use it by looking at Amos and the rule of Jeroboam II, is that this, what he calls the development of a royal consciousness, that is the development of a perspective from the position of privilege and entitlement and power and so on. And he says, you know, this perspective, it has three different kinds of dimensions to it. One is, he calls the economics of affluence. The second is the politics of oppression. And the third is a kind of religious legitimization. And
so we can think of it this way. We have affluence. We've got the economics of affluence and the politics of oppression.
These things are very clear in the book of Amos. So the background to Amos is something like this. Jeroboam II has taken over the throne of Israel, the northern kingdom, not Judah in the south, but Israel in the north. And this is the first half of the 8th century. Prior to this, Israel had been under a lot of duress, mostly from foreign nations that had come in and taken land from them, particularly land on the east side of the Jordan, and some of the land up north. They had been forced to pay tribute to some of these other kingdoms, Assyria, for example. They had to have constant conflict with Syria. And so they were in very sort of strained times. But with Jeroboam II, there's a sort of reign in which they regain their land base, and they regain a kind of place of power and of affluence. And part of that is they're able to reconquer lands from Syria on the east side of the Jordan and up north. In fact, the way it's described in 2 Kings 14, there is this almost a recovery of the land that was equivalent to the Davidic Empire, the Davidic Kingdom. And so it's a real time of like expansion. There's a lot of trade going on. And so they're experiencing a kind of upturn in the economy. And this is evident in the few chapters that are in, or the few verses actually, that are given to Jeroboam II in 2 Kings 14. But it's even more evident in Amos, because Amos is a prophet guy from Judah in the south, and he gets the call from the Lord to go up north into Israel and to speak this prophetic word to, the king, but also to the ruling elite up in Israel. And that's who he addresses his words to. And what becomes clear in Amos is that there is this is a time of expansion and prosperity. And you can hear that being referred to a number of times. So within these prophetic judgments, I guess, against Israel, he says, for example, I will tear down the winter house as well as the summer house. So you've got people, he's obviously talking to people of wealth who have, you know, summer homes and winter homes, houses of ivory. In particular, they're talking about houses that have furniture. This was, archaeologists have uncovered this in the capital city of Samaria in archaeological digs there. Furniture that was inlaid with ivory sort of ornamentation. And it talks about great houses, like big houses. It talks about houses of hewn stone. These are nice flat carved stones that were characteristic of the royal quarters of other Israelite kings. Talks about pleasant vineyards. And then there's this some amazing passage in chapter 6, for example, where he moves into this kind of lament. It's sort of a lament that you might hear at a funeral or something like that. But he turns it, it's interesting, he spins it and turns this lament onto the wealthy. Not people who have died, but of people who are living and apparently living quite well, living quite opulently. He says, "Alas for those who are at ease in Zion and those who feel secure in Mount Samaria, the notables of the first of the nations to whom the house of Israel resorts." You know, the sort of rulers and advocates and people within the court that others in the nation of Israel would come to seek advice or to perhaps get a loan or however that works. And then he goes into more description. "Alas for those who lie on beds of ivory and lounge on their couches and eat lambs from the flock and calves from the stall, who sing idle songs to the sound of the harp and, like David, improvise on instruments of music, who drink wine from bowls and anoint themselves with the finest oils, but are not grieved over the ruin of Joseph. Therefore they shall now be the first to go into exile, and the revelry of the loungers shall pass away." It's an amazing passage for disclosing the sort of lifestyle of the rich and the wealthy, the ruling class, if you like. So all kinds of indicators of this kind of wealth. But in the midst of this partying and revelry and feasting and wine and food galore and fancy furniture and so on, they are not grieved over the ruin of Joseph. They're not, they're not sick to their stomach over the fragmentation of the nation, the way in which they are enjoying this, but many are not. And so there's this kind of engagement in the good life, let's say, but sort of not really being tuned into what's going on elsewhere around them and to the way in which other people's lives are much more difficult and the suffering that's around them. So this is some of the passages that are indicative of this prosperity that lies in the background to Amos. And then the kind of flip side of that affluence for some is the exploitation of others, and particularly exploitation of the poor. And there are three areas that Amos talks about with regard to the poor. In terms of the market, like business and economics, in terms of the court, like access to justice within a court setting, and also within the sanctuary. And so the first thing we hear about Israel in the book of Amos, the first chapter and a half, or chapter and a bit, is all these series of oracles against all the other nations. And Amos, he sets up his listeners. I can imagine this. It's just brilliant. He wanders up to the temple, let's say, in Samaria, and the book begins, with these like judgments on all these nations around him: Edom and Philistia and Moab and Syria and Ammon. And he's just sort of circling Israel with all these other nations, accusing them of war crimes for the ways in which they've sort of acted in war, and the violence and the brutality in which they've conducted themselves, and there's judgment coming for that. And you can hear those Arabians going, "Yeah, give it to them. They deserve it, those guys, those Edomites, those, you know, Syrians," and so on and so on. So he's, you know, you can kind of hear them cheering him on until, the, you know, he goes, "And Judah." They're thinking, "Oh, geez, that's getting close." And then finally, Israel, and they're just shocked. Partly, there's a kind of brilliance about this because he hits seven nations all around. And of course, seven is the number of completion, right? It should be done with seven. And they're the eighth. So I figure they're not expecting it. And it's almost with that idea of, you know, you can see the faults, you can see the problem of the others around you and how they are just sort of brutal and nasty people. But we can't see it going on in our own country. We can't see it going on in our own neighborhoods. And partly it's the ways in which narratives and the discourse that legitimizes inequality and legitimates injustice, we've become used to, we've become mystified by, and it becomes a way in which we simply can't see. Because when Amos comes around to Israel to critique Israel, it wasn't how they treated the Edomites in war or how they treated Judah in war or so on and so on. It was how they treated their own people. For three transgressions of Israel and for four I will not revoke the punishment, because they sell the righteous for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals. They who trample the head of the poor into the dust of the earth and push the afflicted out of the way. Father and son go into the same girl, so that my holy name is profaned. They lay themselves down beside every altar on garments taken in pledge, and in the house of their God they drink wine bought with fines they imposed. So in this particular case, the way in which people, particularly the poor, the vulnerable, whether it's slave girls or people who are beggars or day laborers, people who are struggling to make it, and they are being exploited and sold and treated as economic, you know, goods. Even when they celebrate, and it's one of the things that happens in the book of Amos, you discover, is the people he was addressing were really religious. They loved going to church, we could say it that way. They loved being in the temple, they loved the sacrifices. And here it looks like they lay themselves down beside every altar on garments taken in a pledge. And of course, you know the Deuteronomic law, if you take a garment in a pledge, you have to give it back at night, because the person you took it from, it's their blanket as well. They're going to freeze at night, so they give it back to them. But they didn't give it back to them. They took it into the sanctuary and lay it down on it, perhaps in some ritual of wanting to lie beside an altar in order to get a vision from God. You know, like, I really want to hear the Lord speak to me. But you see, you're lying on something you've taken unjustly. And so this is where the injustice finds its way into the sanctuary. And we're going to see that in a couple other places in Amos. Other references here. He talks about, in chapter 4, verse 1, those who oppress the poor and crush the needy. In chapter 5, he talks about people who trample on the poor and take from them levies of grain. How they afflict the righteous. They take bribes within the courtroom, and they push aside the needy in the gate. The gate is the place within the city where judicial proceedings were heard. So people brought their charges there. And let's say it was somebody who was unjustly treated, who had something taken from them. Maybe, you know, you could imagine somebody like Naboth having his land taken from him, or pressure that way. Maybe he wanted to seek justice, but instead they were pushed out of the way. Like, we don't have time to hear your cause, and, you know, it's ridiculous, and you don't have proper representation anyways, and you don't really understand the language of law, and so we don't really have time for you. In one way or another, pushing people aside so they can't access justice. Talks about turning justice into poison, that is, turning the judicial system into a way that is into something that's toxic, that brings around about death and not life. There's this, I just put down there this line from Isaiah 59 because I find it so amazing. It says, justice is turned back and righteousness stands at a distance. The truth stumbles in the public square, and uprightness cannot enter. And that's very similar to chapter 5, verse 10 in Amos. They hate the one who speaks the truth in the gate. And so on. But then this in chapter 8, this is one of the most concentrated passages on this. Hear this, you that trample on the needy and bring to ruin the poor of the land, saying, this is great, Amos is going to sort of like expose their inner thinking, let us into how they're thinking. When will the new moon be over so we may sell grain, and the Sabbath so we may offer wheat for sale? We will make the ephah small and the shekel great. In other words, we're going to rip some people off here. And practice deceit with false balances, buying the poor for silver and the needy for a pair of sandals, and selling the sweepings of the wheat. So again, this element of exploitation, of injustice, of deceit, of oppression. This is, one gathers, this is the flip side. You know, they're in their feasts with bowls of wine because they're doing this to people. Right? There's a correlation. These are just the flips, the opposite sides of the coin. And so we've got this situation in Amos's day where the ruling elite and the wealthy are enjoying a great deal of the abundance of this time of prosperity. But the poor are being crushed into the ground and taken advantage of, and so on. So this is the backdrop for what's woven through the book of Amos. Now, it's really the last part that I think is the most disturbing for us. And this is why you don't really get too many sermons on Amos, I think. Because
there's this element of religious legitimation.
In other words, the religious establishment sanctions this arrangement of the few who are experiencing all of that wealth affluence, and the many who are being crushed. And it begins in Amos with this line about silencing the prophets. He said, "I raised up some of your children to be prophets and some of your youth to be Nazarites. Is it not so, people of Israel, says the Lord? But you made the Nazarites drink wine." In other words, you sort of forced them to abdicate their vows. "And you commanded the prophets, saying, 'You shall not prophesy.'" We don't want to hear this disturbing word and, you know, all your ranting and raving about, you know, what's wrong and injustice. Like, we don't want to hear it. So, silence to the prophets. One of the great ways, actually, in the biblical text, you can see this in 1 Kings 22. One of the great ways of silencing the prophet is the prophets is to put them on the payroll. So you have Ahab, and he has 400 prophets who are eating at his table. And he says, "Should I go to war against the king of Syria?" And they all say, "Yeah, sure, go to war, you'll win." And he was sort of holding court there with the king of Judah, Jehoshaphat, at the time. And Jehoshaphat says, "Is there any other prophet?" "Oh, yeah, there's this one prophet, Micaiah ben Imlah, but I don't like him. He never says what I want, so I don't trust him." "Well, bring him. Let's hear what he says to say." So they bring him, and he says, "Yeah, go to war. You'll win." And the king Ahab says, "Come on, you're kidding me. Give me the straight goods." He says, "Okay, you're going to be defeated." And the king, of course, is very upset with that and says, "Put him in prison until I get back from battle." And, of course, he goes out and gets killed. But it's this very interesting dynamic of, because there's a couple of other minor scenes in there where one of the heads of the prophets at the table, he's making fun of Micaiah, you know, as sort of this ridiculous prophet. And so here you have this situation where you've got all these prophets on the payroll of the king, and of course they're going to say what the king wants because he's kind of paying them. But then there's this other prophet who is understood in that passage as the true prophet of Yahweh. And he has the contrary word. And so in this particular passage in Amos, we get this sense of not wanting to hear certain prophets, not wanting to hear this true word. Now, this is actually Amos's experience, in fact. And one of the most interesting things about the book is that stuck into all these oracles of judgment, you get one little narrative piece in chapter 7. And it talks about the priest of Bethel, Amaziah, who seems to be in cahoots with the king, Jeroboam II. So then Amaziah, the priest of Bethel, sent to Jeroboam of Israel, saying, "Amos has conspired against you in the very center of the house of Israel. The land is not able to bear all his words." So in other words, very interesting. In the very center of the house of Israel, this is in Bethel, and in the sanctuary in Bethel, which is the main sanctuary of the northern kingdom. And he says, "Amos has conspired against you." There's conspiracy. He's trying to bring you down. Now, think about this. The priest and the king aligned against the prophet. That's an interesting arrangement. Religious power and political power over against the prophetic word. And so you think, well, geez, what did he say? What did Amos say? Get himself into so much trouble. "For Amos has said, 'Jeroboam shall die by the sword, and Israel must go into exile away from his land.'" And then you think, well, that's not so bad. I mean, okay, he's just speak in the future. Yeah, but if you're a king, you know, you want people saying, you know, you're going to die. Like, what if there's, you know, this anti-Jeroboam movement afoot in Israel, and they find out a prophet has said the king's going down, so they're going, yeah, all right, let's get the movement, you know, amped up a bit here. I mean, this could send, you know, the whole thing into chaos. Begins to challenge and disturb those political arrangements of power, and particularly for the king. And it announces something that is contrary, perhaps, to the line he was trying to pitch, like, you know, things are great, we don't have to worry, and so on. And so Amos is perhaps sparking something disturbing for the king. Well, Amaziah sends this word to Jeroboam, but then the text kind of switches quickly there, and then Amaziah turns and speaks to Amos. And he says to Amos, "O seer, go flee to the land of Judah, earn your bread there, and prophesy there." Like, go home. We don't want you here, pal. Besides which, this isn't your country. So just, okay, you're disturbing things. We don't want it. Go home. But never again prophesy at Bethel. Now here comes one of the most interesting lines, the most disturbing lines. For it is the king's sanctuary. It is a temple of the kingdom. This is religious establishment endorsing political power. That's what we're on about. Okay? This belongs to the king. And if you're going to start saying things against the king, well then that's not right with the priest either, with me either. And so you get this kind of this amazing alignment of church and state, or the religious realm endorsing the political realm. Well, if the king was like the king in Psalm 72, you know, it's not so bad, but not against the backdrop of what Amos has been describing here, of this kind of power used to brutalize, oppress, and do violence to the poor. The blood is not precious. The blood of the poor is not precious to this particular king, apparently, or his courtiers. And so Amos is calling that into question, and the priest says, "We don't want to hear about it, because this sanctuary supports the king." And Amos, of course, says, "Well, listen, I'm not really a prophet or a prophet's son. In other words, this isn't my paid occupation. I'm not just doing this because I'm looking for a gig somewhere. This is what the Lord told me to come and say, prophesy to my people Israel. And so here are the consequences of not listening to this prophetic word." So the last thing, there's not only, if we want to think of this kind of religious legitimation of a sort of political, social, economic arrangement of injustice, the prophet comes and the prophet is silenced. And or they attempt to silence him. But also there is this critique of the religious establishment. Very interesting passage in chapter 4. "Come to Bethel and transgress, to Gilgal and multiply transgressions. Now this is perhaps understood to be a parody of the call to worship. Because if you look at these psalms, where it says, for example, Psalm 96, "Ascribe to the Lord the glory due his name, bring an offering, and come into his courts." Or Psalm 100, verse 2, "Worship the Lord with gladness, come into the presence, his presence with singing, enter his gates with thanksgiving, and his courts with praise." So there in the Psalms, you get this injunction to come, worship, come and sing praise, come into the sanctuary. And Amos takes it. It kind of gives it a twist. Come to Bethel and transgress. See, that's the whole thing. It'd be like saying, come to church and sin. You know, we go, what are you talking about, pal? Like church, the sanctuary, that's where like we're really on fire for God. And apparently, according to Amos, like, no. You're coming into this sanctuary, but there is something drastically wrong with the situation. "Bring your sacrifices every morning, your tithes every 3 days." And if you look at this, this is like overkill on the sacrifices and the tithes. Like, You're just supposed to do that, you know, a couple times a year, not every morning or every 3 days. Bring thanks offering of leavened bread. These are all free will offerings. You know, you don't have to do this. Proclaim free will offerings. Publish them, for so you love to do. We cannot look at the book of Amos and say, well, you know why Amos was so mad at them around like the sanctuary and all that kind of stuff? It's because they were worshiping false gods. You can't find that in Amos. They were, it appears they were true Yahwehs. They were truly devoted to Yahweh as their God. And they brought sacrifices. They had all kinds of expressions of devotion and commitment. And they loved it. They loved going to church. They loved the worship and the celebration and so on. And yet somehow he's construing this as like problematic. Like, what is Amos's problem here? And then in chapter 5, seek me and live, but do not seek Bethel. Seek me and live, but don't go to church. Right? That's problematic. And so, you know, it's no wonder people, you know, didn't want Amos around. They wanted him to go home. But do not enter into Gilgal or cross over to Beersheba and these other sanctuaries, for Gilgal will go into exile and Bethel shall come to nothing. And then comes this sort of the final passage. It seems in each one of these there's a kind of concentrated text that focuses on these three elements. So this is the one that Amos is known for. I hate, I despise your festivals. I take no delight in your solemn assemblies. Even though you offer me burnt offerings and grain offerings, I will not accept them. And the offerings of well-being of your fatted animals, I will not look upon. Take away from me the noise of your songs. I will not listen to the melody of your harps. But let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. And in this particular passage, of course, we could go into detail, but we don't really have time. This concentration of language of rejection, like the hate, the despise, unique kind of combinations, very intense in the Hebrew text, as well as a kind of clustering of the senses. I won't smell your burnt offerings. I won't listen to your songs. I won't look upon your fatted animals. All of these senses that God's like closing down. I'm not going to look. I'm not going to smell. I'm not going to hear. And it has to do with the offerings. It has to do with songs. All the things that were to make the gathering at the sanctuary what it was. This very powerful experience of devotion and affirmation. And then it says, the counter. I reject all of this, but let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream. Justice and righteousness, when they're paired together like this, really, the mishpat and tzedakah really form a kind of phrase that signifies social justice. Like the right relationships, equal distribution of resources, a welcome participation in the community, and so on. It is the justice, the righteousness and justice, the same two terms show up in that Psalm 72 passage. And this is supposed to flow like water. It's supposed to flow like a nachal etan. You know, in Israel, a lot of the rivers and the streams, they dry up in the summer. They just don't flow. The water dries up. But this is an ever-flowing stream, never dries up. And this kind of justice and righteousness is to go on and on and on as a source of life to the community. Now, one of the ways in which we slip out of the like disturbing nature of these verses is that we say, well, I think God must have been pretty upset because, you know, they're doing all these external rituals, but they just didn't have the heart. They weren't devoted to him in their heart. And the interesting thing is you could look all the way through Amos and you can't find any reference to heart. Heart's never mentioned. Doesn't seem to be the real issue here. The real issue here is not what you do externally and then what you feel inside. The real issue is what goes on in the sanctuary and what goes on in the marketplace or in the city gate. Okay? It's this contrast. What happens here in the sanctuary religious worship, devotion, all those kinds of acts. And yet, there's an endorsement. Apparently, Amaziah is on side with this. There's an endorsement of a situation out in that society in which there is injustice, in which people are being trampled on. And this is unacceptable. If we're going to worship in here, then we have to connect our worship here with what's going on out there. Now, the interesting thing is, Amos, as a prophet, does what all prophets do. He takes the position alongside the victims of injustice. Okay? He doesn't come into Israel and say, you know, you're doing a lot of things right. You got some things going. It looks like economically things are pretty good. Maybe you could just tweak this, tweak that. He's not saying that. He takes the stand in his critique. As he speaks to the ruling elite and the wealthy of that society, he takes the stand of alongside those who are pressed down, those who are crushed, the poor, the needy, the weak, the servant girls. He takes the stand there. And from that vantage point, he looks out into society and he says, there's something wrong. Because in one ear, he's listening to the cries of the suffering. And that orients him to the world. And that orients him to divine justice. And it's that place that we have to stand. Not the discourse of the educated, the discourse of the wealthy is powerful discourse. And it can be very persuasive. But we are called within this prophetic tradition to stand with the victims of structural injustice and to say, all I'm hearing is the cries of the suffering. And that tells me something is wrong. And we need to look out and say, what's wrong? What's going on here? Why are people increasingly homeless? Why are there so many in poverty? Why are there so many desperate? And let me give you an example of that, and then I'm going to shut up. I've gone on way too long. A year or two ago, they passed the Safe Streets Act in Vancouver and around. And the Safe Streets Act was meant to allow, to create a law, basically, for prosecuting people who were aggressive panhandlers. And it's very interesting to me that the way we deal with desperation in the society is through laws that outlaw desperation. So we're not going to look at the reason for the despair. Why are people panhandling in the first place? And why are people aggressively panhandling? It seems like it's driven by despair and by this kind of element of exclusion and humiliation and so on. And instead of saying, what's wrong with us as a society? We say, what's wrong with you, pal? You know, I'm trying to drink my Starbucks, you know, cafe mocha or whatever, and you keep bugging me for money. And, of course, it is irritating. But I always find it interesting, like, we don't like that face-to-face solicitation by someone who's in despair and who maybe looks, like, unkempt or whatever. But we don't mind, like, endless solicitation from, like, advertising firms out of New York, for example. You know, they're slick, and they got beautiful people. And we could be solicited by them all day. But put a poor guy right in our face while we're trying to, you know, and that despair so close to us. Let's get a law. Let's get these people out of here. We don't want them. So what happens is we have a system that perpetuates despair, that perpetuates a sense of lostness, of humiliation and exclusion. And then we punish them for being that way. We don't want that, you know, too close. Instead of saying, what's going on? How is it that over here we've got so much and over here they have none? What is happening here? What are the structural issues? And when we talk about justice, that's what we have to talk about. We have to talk about structural distribution of resources and power and so on and how that is arranged. And the prophet takes the stand beside the suffering, beside the victims, beside the poor, and declares the divine word from that place.
Okay, well, I think I'm done. But I want to read you one quote.
In the imperial world, this is from Rubens that I mentioned. In the imperial world of Pharaoh and Solomon, the prophetic alternative, which is justice really, is a bad joke. Either to be squelched by force or ignored in satiation. But we are a haunted people because we believe the bad joke is rooted in the character of God himself. Psalm 72. A God who is not the reflection of Pharaoh or Solomon. He is a God uncredentialed in the empire, unknown in the courts, unwelcomed in the temple. And his history begins in the attentiveness to the cry up to the cries of the marginalized. He, unlike his royal regents, is one whose person is presented as passion and pathos. The power to care, the capacity to weep, the energy to grieve, and then to rejoice. The prophets after Moses know that his caring, weeping, grieving, and rejoicing will not be outflanked by royal hardware or royal immunity, because this one is indeed God.
Okay. Thanks, Dave. That's quite a quote. What time is it? Does someone have a watch? Sorry, I don't have a watch. 9 o'clock. Okay. We're supposed to have a coffee break now. But I think some of us have questions that we want to answer. 5 minutes, little stretch. There's some cookies out over there in the room over there. And we'll come back for 5 or 10 after. We're going to be finished by 9:30, okay? So we'll leave ourselves 20 minutes or so for questions, okay? So out this way here, down the hallway, there are some coffee and some cookies. We'll be back in 10 minutes for that's a question. If you have questions that you want to put, you can put the symptoms, like...
The symptoms would be poverty, sickness. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, part of it is, I think there's always like these two elements of the personal and the political. So in the, now when I say political, I'm not talking about political parties. I don't have that much interest in that stuff. What I mean is like the polis, the life of the city, and how power and resources are structured within, you know, the city or the community. And I think that, so on the one hand, I think partly we need, well, if I borrow this term from Ched Myers, we need a conversion. But the conversion is a long process. And it's a long process of transformation of our perspective and our understanding, what it means to, for example... live with the... I mean, we're saturated in a world in which we're told never be satisfied, always want more. So we have to count... I mean, that comes in millions of ways, and it comes with very, very powerful sort of structures, institutions, and technology driving that home for us. So how do we develop, let's say, within... Well, partly ourselves individually, but partly as a church, how do we develop an economics of enough? Like when we can say, you know, it's enough. I've got enough. And so, let's say I'm working full time. I'm making X number of dollars. But I can live on, you know, I can live on this. This is enough. And so the excess, the extra resources goes into other things that can be of benefit for other people. And it might come in various ways of, you know, providing, developing, I don't know, you can imagine things of like social housing or various other things. But I think one of the things has to do with a change of perspective, a change of attitude. And so that is enough. And I think there's a lot of, this economics of enough. I think there's a lot of support for that in the biblical text. Remember the manna text? They go out every day. And if they collected more than they needed, it went bad on them. And this kind of idea of, okay, this is sufficient for me. Here, we'll share it with you. You know, so we need more of that. Because I think our reaction, our instincts, is because we've internalized these very powerful messages that says upward mobility, you're worth as much as you accumulate, and so on. There's this endless desire for more and a dissatisfaction with what you have. So that notion of contentment. So on the one hand, I think we need to go through a process of conversion that means a reshaping of our thinking, a reshaping of our desires, a reshaping of how we see ourselves as not simply individuals, but as members of a community. That's another huge element of our culture. It's not only like whatever, endless acquisition, but it's also hyper-individualism. You know, stand on your own two feet, pick yourself up, make something of yourself. And so we have deeply internalized a perspective of individualism. And I think we need to counter that. And I think we need to counter it by beginning to think of not what's good for me, but what's good for us. And so develop a sense of the common good. And I think I always imagine that, like, we can find ways of trying to articulate these things in the public square. Like, why turn over all of the space, public space, to those endless messages of consumption and individualism and so on? Why not say something other than that in those public spaces? So I'm all up for, like, public symbolic actions that awaken imagination. Because I think that's the other thing, and we've shrunken our imagination. But also I think that maybe there's a place in which small communities, and in that sense I think churches, as small communities, can begin to embody these alternative ways of living and take that pretty seriously. And perhaps that way becomes a model and helps to alter our own thinking and begins to perhaps seep out into the world around us as a way of a catalyst for change. So I think we've got to work at that personal level, a communal level, also then begin to see ourselves also standing in that prophetic tradition of speaking truth to power, or however we describe it, offering an alternative perspective. Brueggemann talks about it as an alternative consciousness, a prophetic imagination, and that's where I think we get at the deep things. But I think we can't be naive about how deeply we have been shaped by the forces of our culture. And the process of conversion is a kind of slow and painful one. Because it's very hard for people who are entitled and privileged in the culture to give that up. And there's a lot of messages around that say, don't be silly, that's ridiculous, don't do that. And I don't know, I think we need to do this together, honestly. I think we need to do this together as a community. I think we're dead in the water if we think we can just do this on our own. And so we need to figure out how to live together, how to share resources together, to celebrate together, how to rethink things together. But then also to, provoke the imagination and let it loose out in these public spaces, and it becomes disturbing out there.
The objection that comes to my mind is, well, I think my mind is simplified.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I have a feeling perhaps I'm not the only one.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's good. It's excellent. Okay, here's my take on that. When I see someone like that, the first thing I begin to realize, I think one of the things is we have to see that person in their uniqueness and individuality to the extent that we can, and a posture of like honor and dignity and so on. But at the same time, I recognize that this is a kind of manifestation of systemic injustice and violence. Okay. So that this person is, and I am too, we're both caught within this kind of vortex of power that spits some people out in this way. So I think, okay, the guy's probably going to use, but you know, he's probably had a hell of a life and I'd probably use too. He's trying to numb the pain. And I numb the pain by, I don't know, going to a Canucks game or, you know, purchasing IKEA furniture or something. So he's firing stuff into his arm and I'm like, you know, racking up my Visa card. Like really, you know, our culture shrinks our lives so immensely. And so I recognize that this is a lot bigger than just my giving the guy a buck or two. But so I feel sorrow. Like, I feel kind of grief, and I feel anger, and I know this is a bigger thing. And so in that recognition, then I feel like I have a better angle on it, a better picture of what's going on. And so I don't feel that necessary. And so in many ways, for me to give is, first of all, because I want to practice open-handedness. It has more to do with how I want to be, who I want to become. But it's also that, and if he blows it on dope, you know, like, it's all right. I mean, I wish it was different. But, you know, somebody hands money over to me in the form of a paycheck and I blow it on, like, stupid things to, like, numb my pain of feeling, like, completely useless or meaningless or humiliated or whatever, you know? Like, and so I think what we have to do is we might give that dollar, but we have to realize that, you know, we're in a struggle, we're in a battle to imagine a different world and to live into that. And so while I give him that small token of whatever it is and probably badly, you know, done or whatever, I know the battle I'm on. I know what I'm on about. And he's a reminder of what that is. And that no one should be excluded from that. I think one of the things to think about in a lot of that is the issue of addiction. And, you know, this Prof. SFU wrote this book, wrote this paper called The Roots of Addiction, and one of the things that he argues is that under capitalism, we have a great deal of dislocation. And because we're always moving, so live here, live here, live here, follow where the job is, a lot of dislocation. So we're alienated and isolated from one another, a culture of hyper-individualism and competition. And the result of that is a great deal of dislocation, alienation, and loneliness. And this is the root of addiction. Doesn't matter whether your addiction is legal or illegal. And so I recognize in the face of that person my own isolation and alienation and the kind of addictiveness that perhaps the root that can grow there. And so, yeah, I mean, I think when you set it into that framework, then it becomes like, I don't know. I feel like I can just engage with the person truly, more honestly. Or I get like this more genuine and authentic sort of engagement. Whether I give or I don't give, I feel like I know the pain, and I'm really sorry, and I'm going to try to live into something better, into something different. And here's, you know, Toonie. I don't know. I don't know how to do it, really.
Humiliating, or, you know, to get that.
Yeah.
So you kind of,
No, I, yeah, that's, no, that's, yeah, that's good. I'm really bad at it. I don't know, I give to my friends who are on the street, but, yeah, so I don't really know. I think a lot of it is that I just want to live more like this and not like this, so I got to practice, somehow I got to practice, and, it's just a lot of pain out there. And there's a lot of pain here, too. Oh man, see, this is the problem. People see, you know, church and state, we separated, we're doing our own thing. This is great. We could never fall into what's going on in Amos. But I'm thinking, are you kidding me? I mean, the church gets big, big buildings, gets, you know, starts being operated like it's a corporate, you know, entity, and they're looking for more numbers, and we get high tech, and, you know, we're going all this road. Meanwhile, the individuals are like out there consuming and participating and, you know, doing all the things everybody else is doing, being totally legit and pursuing status and, you know, whatever in the culture, sticking to their entitlement and privilege and so on. And then we think we're different. We're not different. We're just endorsing the whole system. And largely, it's like as they silence the prophet, we say nothing about these structural injustices. We say nothing. You know, we might have a few moral issues that we're going to stand up on. But, I mean, issues of those kind of structural things like, you know, inequality or, you know, the rise of poverty or homelessness or these kinds of things. Like, we don't say anything. We go, and I think to myself, after reading this Amos 5 passage, like, why are we sending people to, like, worship conventions? Like, why is it that when we hire, for example, we hire people that lead worship, that do, you know, kids ministry, that do this and do that and do all these things. Who hires a social justice guy or woman or person or whatever? You know, like, who says, we need to know what's going on in our society around us and we need to take that and analyze that carefully. We need to be critical analysts of the culture, and we have to read the biblical text carefully, and then we have to work out an imaginative response that embodies the kingdom and its values. How are we going to do that? We need someone to help us think through that. I don't know. I don't know any. I mean, there are not too many places that have anything quite like a social justice committee, for example. Never mind hire someone to be thinking through this. And I just think so basically we're going along and improving, you know, our worship, our singing, and we get slicker at that and so on and so on. But mostly we're endorsing what goes on in the culture, if not overtly, then by our silence. So in other words, we think we're separate, but we're not. We're actually just perpetuating the whole shebang. I mean, that would be my read. So I think we're in trouble. I think we're in real trouble. And that's why the call to justice is huge, because it's going to be very costly. Because as soon as you start to move in these circles, as Amos does, and begin to speak, articulate something different, you get ostracized. You sort of are viewed as kind of odd. And then, of course, if you end up really stepping on a nerve, like, say, Oscar Romero, who in a position of real power within the church, and therefore in El Salvador at the time, socially and politically, and he takes a stand with poor people, campesinos, people being disappeared and so on. He takes a stance and he calls for people to stop the repression and all this. I mean, you start doing that, you're going to get a bullet. I mean, metaphorically or literally. And I don't, I'm not trying to be drastic here, but I mean, it just seems to be the case. Martin Luther King, You know, you just, you know, you start to call for something different that threatens political or social or economic privilege of people, and they're going to rally and start to defend. Well, it seems to me that if we're going to walk this way of justice, we're going to be kind of out of sync with the culture. Well, as I said, I'm not really like I'm not that keen on like party politics stuff. I think whoever's in power, we have to speak this vision to those in power. Doesn't matter to me what party they are. So we're always going to push for better distribution of resources, support for people, and essentially try to push for the care of the least, right? That, for me, and people who are suffering. As a result of this system. So I'm always going to push on that front. I don't hold out a lot of hope necessarily in like the political process, but you got to be involved in the fray. And even if you are able to secure, you know, I don't know, some housing over here or a few more resources over there, like it's better than not, I suppose. So, in my view, it always has this dimension of politics with a small p, as in the life of the city, and how power and resources and status and all, how that all works, how we honor one another, how people are included or excluded. It always works into those in those ways, works itself out those ways, and so I don't think you can avoid it. And the thing that there's a kind of perception. I think the church I grew up in would have said we're apolitical, like we're not involved in politics. Because I do remember one guy once standing up. I think he prayed at a meeting for the NDP or something, and he got kicked out of the church. But their thing was like we're not political. And now that I look at it, I say that's baloney. If you cannot not be political. If you say well we're just not involved, then you're endorsing the status quo. That's just the way it is. And so if you're going to do that, then you are political. So you've got to be in, you're in the fray. You can't not be. Either you're endorsing it or you're trying to move it in a different direction or within it embody an alternative vision.
Trash heaps, and they were fasting 2 weeks out of a month. so that they could give the money they saved to the poor. And that's what changed the world. And so I sometimes wonder if we as Christians, we look at what's happening, we say, well, we just got to change the system. If we get the system working better, then everything will be as God wants. And it's like, how are we going to change a system that's really anti-God? Like, maybe the prophetic voice needs to primarily be in the church. And say, you know what, God is not a God that doesn't care about poor and marginal, so we can't be like that either. So we got to be different. And it doesn't matter what the rest of society does, we're going to live differently. Mm-hmm. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I hear you.
What do you think? Like, how do we keep the two? Because I think we do need to speak out to society, but I think if we're maybe speaking to death here, it's people who don't honor the same God we honor. We just got to live differently.
But it might be that the vision that's inspired by these texts and this particular God is a vision that, because he's the creator God, that there is something about, like, the ultimacy of that vision for all of humanity and not just for those who identify themselves as, you know, belonging to this God. So I think that would be one. And the other thing is that it's just very difficult when you are trying to love your neighbor, and your neighbor turns out to be someone who is sort of pretty directly affected by these structures of injustice. And to say, well, like, I really care about you, but then to allow these things to happen to him without somehow standing alongside that neighbor out of love for them and saying, this has got to change, you know? We can't allow this to happen. So to go into these places of these where the structures press in on the lives of individual people and call for, like, just awaken a consciousness of the humanity of one another, that we are our brother's keeper, our sister's keeper. We need to take this seriously. And that just that things can be different. Like, we can live better than this, you know, than have these kinds of lives discarded. And so I think that we're going to be led into those places of confrontation and of, like, a prophetic stance. It's inevitable if we really care about people. That doesn't mean that necessarily I have a lot of hope of some kind of ultimate success. I'll leave that to the eschaton, you know, the end. But at the same time, if we imagined a reality, the ultimate reality is, you know, Revelation 21, where there's this kind of a picture of no more crying and no more death. And that's going to be like the ultimate reality that wins out. Okay, now I'm going to live towards that. Like, I'm going to work in terms of living out a kind of trajectory that embodies it now and that calls for that now. And it says we can do better in sort of eliminating suffering and death and so on. So, I mean, we can do this. I mean, and so it becomes a matter of awakening consciousness and living that way in the fray. Like, why is it that poor people disproportionately by massive amounts die of tuberculosis, but rich people don't? Like, we can redistribute resources. We need to push and keep saying that, because there are people who are dying for no reason, unnecessarily. And so I think part of it's challenging the logic that's driving the society, and partly it's a way of loving my neighbor who, you know, is being treated this way. So, no, I mean, I understand. I just think if this is the heart of God and we think this is, like, the most real thing going, then we need to live out that heart. And we need to challenge people to live towards that, something more just. Yeah, I don't know. Anyways, you said 9:30. Oh, my gosh.
Good.
The evening. Yeah. Well, thank you so much. And I look forward to Wednesday. We're going to look at the Good Samaritan, but with some real interesting twists.
Is of particular interest for me, and So I want to spend tonight doing that. And it's also kind of intriguing that he made reference to the Good Samaritan story, because on Wednesday night, I want to talk about that. And we're going to look at Luke 10. But maybe from an angle or drawing things out of the story that aren't normally